Here, starting around chapter 40, a guy named Johanan. In chapter 40, this man named Johanan warned a guy named Gedaliah about a plot against his life. Gedaliah ignored him. And then in chapter 41, this Johanan shows up after Gedaliah gets killed. And then in chapter 42, this Johanan and company, 42:1, after they had killed some people, after Babylon came in, they wanted to hightail it down to Egypt. But before they left, they wanted to get God's opinion about it. Not that it mattered, but they at least wanted to ask. And the Lord told them, nope, don't go. But they were going to go anyway. And that's usually how people view the Bible. They pick and choose what they like. And they agree with what they like. And then they pitch out what they don't like. If you talk to the average person on the street, you ask them if they believe in heaven or hell. Most will say, well, I believe in a heaven. But that thing on hell, no, I don't believe that. Pick and choose. They want to take the positive. They don't want to take the negative. And it's either you got to take all of it or none of it. It's the only way to go about with this thing. Okay, Jeremiah 43, the same feller, Johanan and company. They've ignored what Jeremiah said, who got it from the Lord, and now they're taken off to Egypt. Jeremiah 43:1. It came to pass that when Jeremiah had made an end of speaking unto all the people all the words of the Lord their God, for which the Lord their God had sent him to them, even all these words, then spake Azariah the son of, not their feller, and Johanan the son of Kareah, that guy, or Kareah, whatever, and all the, notice the wording, all the proud men. Proud men. They're not going to listen to what God says. Job 41, verse 34 says that Leviathan is the king over the children of pride. So it says, and all the proud men saying unto Jeremiah, thou speaketh falsely. Well, he quoted some things right from God, and they said, you're lying to us. Thou speakest falsely. The Lord our God hath not sent thee to say, go not into Egypt to sojourn there. But Baruch, the son of Neriah, setteth thee on against us for to deliver us into the hand of the Chaldeans, that they might put us to death and carry us away captive into Babylon. Okay, this guy named Baruch is like Jeremiah's secretary or helper or whatnot. He was like his messenger, I guess would be the best word, his messenger. When Jeremiah was in jail, Baruch would be the one that would write down the words, and he'd be one that delivered the messages, and he'd be the one that would read them out in public. And these fellows was blaming Baruch. They were saying, oh, he's just been slandering us and all this stuff. And the Lord told them, don't go to Egypt. These guys already had it made up in their mind. They weren't going to change their mind. You weren't going to confuse them with the facts because their mind was already made up. And that's a lot of times when you happen to talk to somebody about the NIV, if you get in that discussion, you can talk till you're blue in the face and they're not going to change a thing. Got their mind made up. And that's the way people are. That is the actual word for, that's the actual, not word, but the actions of a bigot. A bigot is somebody who refuses to listen to the facts. Now, generally, a Bible believer, or if you expose the Catholic Church, that's their charge against us. The Bible believers. Oh, we're bigots. We won't listen. Well, I'll listen. But they don't want to seem to hear anything. It's funny. Several years ago, I had a pastor across town down in Rensselaer. that had slandered me on a few occasions to one of our own church members. So she was willing to testify to the fact. She did. After I'd questioned him a little bit, I said, "Don't know if it's true, but I understand you said such and such." And he denied it, of course, and so I hit the speakerphone and I asked this person if she would tell me what the guy said. And as she was speaking, he was getting shorter and shorter. And after hung up the phone, he said, "Well, I might have said something like that." And I said, "Yeah, I know people like you. You like to shoot your mouth off and you don't want to be held accountable for it." "Well, you wouldn't listen to me anyway." Oh, so he's accusing me of being a bigot. So I proceeded to try to show him in his New American Standard perversion that it was a fake Bible, and he didn't seem to want to listen. So he refused to listen, even though he's accusing me of not refusing to listen. It's funny how people are. But that word bigot, that's easy to just to flash around. And usually people that use that word, it's nothing but intimidation. I took Janet down to the airport on Tuesday, and of course we stopped at the highfalutin Goodwill store on the way while we were waiting. Picked up a book in there about Catholic and the liberties of America. And this guy wrote this thing back in the 50s, and he just basically laid out, if you actually tell the truth about the Catholic Church, this is what they're going to say about you. And he laid it all out. It was pretty good. I don't know if he's a saved man or not. But a little bit of what I read. Now, those are certain catchwords that you have people brand you, and it's all purpose is intimidation. Bigot's one, narrow-minded's one, racist is one. They're all meant for intimidation. Whenever you have a discussion with somebody, if race comes up with anybody, that is their last argument. Race. They've run out of all excuses, so now they got to bring up the race card. That's their last argument. And it's interesting, all civil rights legislation supposedly are designed to stop judging people by the color of their skin, but that's exactly what they do. Okay, so they're accusing somebody. Verse 3, they're accusing Baruch of telling Jeremiah, "Don't let him go." Okay, but this is a standard thing of blaming somebody else. I always think it's kind of funny. People say, "Well, you think you're right and everybody else is wrong." You know what? Everybody believes that. People say, "Well, you think your church is right and everybody should come to your church." Well, I think every preacher ought to believe that. I think it's just the right thing to do. If it's not the best, then make it the best. And if somebody throws that charge at you, you think you're right, okay, then tell me where you're wrong, pal. Several years ago, Dale King and I were knocking some doors in Rensselaer, and the door flew open, and there's a man sitting in the living room, and I said, "My name is Dave," and he said, "Hoffman." I said, "Oh, you know me?" He said, "I listen to you on the radio." I said, "Okay." I said, "Is that good or bad?" He said, "Both." I said, "Okay." So he invited us in. We got chatting about some things, an older man. And he went to a Mennonite church down there that was NIV. And so we got in discussion about the NIV. He wanted to talk about that. And I answered his questions very gently because he's an older man. I was a younger feller and all that stuff. And I just looked at him and said, "Hey, I'm just a young fella. I'm not going to come in your house and tell you what you're supposed to believe. It's a free country." But he kept persisting asking questions. So I showed him 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 1. And it says, "Finally, brethren, pray for us that the word of the Lord may have free course and be glorified." And I asked him, I said, "You tell me I'm doing wrong by bragging about the book after reading that verse." He couldn't. And then a couple minutes later, he says, "Well, you think you're right and everybody else is wrong." And I just looked at him and I said, yeah, people who refuse to study because they're lazy usually make that charge. Got kind of quiet in there. Because that's usually the truth. That's almost always the truth. He refused to study. Well, I get a letter from him a couple weeks later, and he says, well, I heard a different David Hoffman on radio this morning. You changed it, blah, blah, blah. And I checked all the tapes and thought, I didn't change anything. I think I got his attention. Or I hope the truth got his attention. Okay, so the thing is, we got to search the thing out. Verse 4, it says, so Johanan, the son of Kareah, I guess that's how you pronounce his name, and all the captains of the forces and all the people obeyed not the voice of the Lord to dwell in the land of Judah. They wouldn't stay there. Okay, verse 5, but Johanan, son of Kareah, and all the captains of the forces took all the remnant of Judah and or that were returned from all nations, whether they had been driven to dwell in the land of Judah, even men and women and children and the king's daughters, and every person that Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, had left with Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and Jeremiah the prophet and Baruch, the son of Neriah. So they're kidnapping them. They're kidnapping these guys, making them go with them. 7, so they came into the land of Egypt, for they obeyed not the voice of the Lord. Thus came they even to Tahpanhes. So here now they got Jeremiah and Baruch kidnapped. They shanghaied them, took them down there. Why would they want to take the guys? They said, you guys lied to us anyway. In their heart, they knew he was telling the truth. So Jeremiah, he's got his second wind. Verse 8, then came the word of the Lord unto Jeremiah in Tahpanhes, saying, take great stones in thy hand and hide them in the clay in the brick kiln, which is at the entry of Pharaoh's house in Tahpanhes, in the sight of the men of Judah, and say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will send and take Nebuchadnezzar, here with an R, the king of Babylon, my servant, and will set his throne upon these stones that I have hid, and he shall spread his royal pavilion over them. And when he cometh, he shall smite the land of Egypt and deliver such as are for death to death, and such as are for captivity to captivity, and such as are for the sword to sword. And I will kindle a fire in the houses of the gods of Egypt, and he shall burn them and carry them away captives, and he shall array himself with the land of Egypt as a shepherd putteth on his garment, and he shall go forth from thence in peace. He shall break also the images of Beth Shemesh that is in the land of Egypt, and the house of the gods of the Egyptians shall he burn with fire. So, that's pretty straightforward and plain. Now, Lord, don't think much of Egypt. Ain't that a fact? Okay, so that's 43. It's pretty self-explanatory. These guys ran down to Egypt. They're not supposed to be in Egypt. And Egypt is a raunchy place to be. In the Bible, it says out of Egypt over 70 times. It says out of the land of Egypt over 80 times. And 10 times it says Egypt is the house of bondage. Why would we want to go back there? Okay, Egypt is where all the new Bibles come from. Revised Standard, NIV, everything. This Christian contemporary music, that's Egyptian music. It's got the beat and everything. So what they're doing is they're pulling everybody, the Christians now, everybody's trying to get back in Egypt. Going back to slavery, that's what they're doing. Worst place to go to. The Lord was so fanatical about that, he didn't want any of his bones left down here in Egypt, resurrected from the dead. Joseph said, I don't want my bones staying here. Bring mine out of here. And his daddy said, you make sure you take my bones out of here. The manuscripts from Egypt take a boat up to the Vatican. You'll find that in Acts chapter 27, where a ship from Alexandria take Paul to Rome. One ship sunk, So then they had to get another ship. The Revised Version, 1881, it sunk. They got another one, American Standard Version, it sunk. And then you get another one, they keep sinking. They got holes in them. Okay, the old King James Bible, it's still floating, even though we got some people riding on the ship. They're always trying to bring water back into the ship. I don't know why they're riding the ship. They ought to just get off. But that's what they're doing. Okay, Jeremiah 44. Now, this chapter's got the famous Queen of Heaven in here. Jeremiah 44. Verse 1, the word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the Jews which dwell in the land of Egypt, which dwell at Migdol and at Tahpenes and at Naph and in the country of Pathros, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, ye have seen all the evil that I have brought upon Jerusalem and upon the cities of Judah, and behold, this day they are desolation, and no man dwelleth therein. Because of their wickedness, which they have committed to provoke me to anger, so that, or in that, they went to burn incense and to serve other gods, whom they knew not, neither they, ye, nor your fathers. Howbeit, I sent unto you all my servants, the prophets, rising early and sending them, saying, oh, do not this abominable thing that I hate. Notice the Lord's reaction on this situation. The Lord hates this abominable thing. As we keep reading, we're going to find out who he's talking about. And not only does he hate them, they hate God. These people who have these idols, look in Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. If you get yourself in the little habit when you're driving up 41 and you see Mary out there floating out there, pray for your country, because that's a sign of judgment. If you want to see a modern day grove, which are forbidden in the Bible, take a trip down to St. Joe College, drive in the back, and you'll have a grove back there. Drive right past the priest's house where the beer trucks always stop and bring a bunch of cases out and set them right there by the priest's house. And then you go on in the back, and there's a grove back there. And that's a sign of judgment. Anybody putting up statues, little Mary statue, whatever statue they're going to have, St. Christopher, St. Bernard, all these statues around, that's a sign that these people hate God. Exodus 20, verse 4. If you get the Ten Commandments listed out by the Catholic Church, they will skip this one. They skip this one, and then they split the tenth one. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image, or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself to them, nor serve them. For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. People making them idols hate God. And what they do is they take them idols and like to stick them in a box. That's the purpose of the idols. They think that they can keep God in a building so that from Monday to Saturday they can do their pretty well what they want to do. Then they come back and see God when they make the confessional. Then they get back out and do their thing. You can't put God in a box. God knows our very thoughts. Okay, so the Lord says this is abominable. Verse 4, the Lord hates this. Verse 5, but they hearken not, nor incline their ear to turn from their wickedness, to burn no incense unto other gods. Wherefore, my fury and my anger was poured forth, and was kindled in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, and they are wasted and desolate as at this day. Idolatry is the number one sin that's mentioned in the Bible more than anything. Sins of the mouth is number two. Verse 7, therefore now thus saith the Lord, the God of hosts, the God of Israel, wherefore commit ye this great evil against your souls, to cut off from you man and woman, child and suckling, out of Judah, to leave you none to remain. In that ye provoke me unto wrath with the works of your hands, burning incense unto other gods in the land of Egypt, whither ye be gone to dwell, that ye might cut yourselves off, and that ye might be a curse and a reproach among all nations of the earth. Have you forgotten the wickedness of your fathers and the wickedness of the kings of Judah? And the wickedness of their wives and your own wickedness and the wickedness of your wives, which they have committed in the land of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem. Now, isn't it interesting? Why does it mention the wickedness of the women? Well, it's because when the women go bad in a society, you've got a real bad society. Women tend to be more spiritual than men. Now, obviously, they also tend to be prone to deception more so than men. But when you have a society where the women get wicked, you have a real bad society. Men are always wicked. You always have wicked men. But when the women get wicked, that's a real bad society. So that's why they're mentioned twice. And the women usually, the wicked girls usually travel in pairs, like Lot's two daughters. Okay, like the two in Ezekiel 16 and 23. Verse 10, they are not humbled even unto this day. They will not humble themselves. Neither have they feared. They don't fear God. They're even now putting little banners up. You know, no fear, no fear, no fear. Most of the ones with no fear, you put a 9mm right here and cock it, they'll fear. I'll get scared. No fear. No fears. That's not a sign of intelligence. You ought to fear driving through a red light. That's a good, healthy fear. You ought to fear jumping off the edge of a bridge. You ought to fear God. You ought to fear His book. Okay, so it says, neither have they feared, nor walked in my law, nor my statutes that I set before you and before your fathers. Therefore, thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will set my face against you for evil and to cut off all of Judah. This is the God of love. Okay, this is the same God, same character all through the Bible. And when God is against the man, you're in trouble. When God is for you, nobody can be against you. But when God is against you, nobody can be for you. Don't have a choice in that. Verse 12, he says, I will take the remnant of Judah. Notice it's always a small crowd. That have set their faces to go into the land of Egypt to sojourn there. And they shall all be consumed and fall in the land of Egypt. Jeremiah told them, don't do this. They shall even be consumed by the sword and by the famine. They shall die from the least, even unto the greatest, by the sword and by the famine. They shall be in a... I say that, excreation, and an astonishment, and a curse, and a reproach. And I will punish them that dwell in the land of Egypt, as I have punished Jerusalem by the sword, by the famine, by the pestilence, so that none of the remnant of Judah which are gone into the land of Egypt to sojourn there. Notice, to sojourn there. They weren't planning on staying. They're just passing through. That's the typical thing. To sojourn there shall escape or remain, that they should return into the land of Egypt to which they have a desire to return to dwell there. For none shall return but such as shall escape. Now 15, we're getting into some hate literature. This is hate literature which would not be allowed in any public school in America. This is censored. You know, they don't like it when you censor Harry Potter. But the Bible has been on the censorship list for years in a public school. These real broad-minded intellectual folks, they can't read a Bible. It puts them in a conniption of fit just to open a Bible. They go bonkers. Why? Verse 15. Then all the men which knew that their wives had burned incense unto other gods, and all the women that stood by, a great multitude, even all the people that dwelt in the land of Egypt, and Pathros answered Jeremiah, saying, notice precisely how it's written. The men allow their wives to do something. The men don't get into it, but the wives really get into it. The men sitting in these churches, you'll find them sleeping half the time. They know Father Flanagan behind the thing's a liar. They've done smoked when drank with him. They know he's probably altered altar boys several times. They want nothing to do with the guy. They'll sit in there and sleep through the Mass. But she'll sit in there and admire everything that's going on. The wives are the one behind the thing. The wives are the one pushing it. The men just go along with it. Why do they go along with it? They got to live with her. She's going to pester them until she's afraid he's going to go to hell or, you know, get stuck in purgatory. And when he dies, she will go and pay for the high Mass and the low Mass to pray to get him out of purgatory. And she'll spend everything she's got to get him out of purgatory when there's no such animal. One of these older ladies, I was in Colorado Springs, knocked on the doors, came across this elderly lady, and she goes to Mass every single day. I said, "Ma'am, I'd like to show you how you can know for sure you're going to heaven." "No, sonny, I'm okay. I go to Mass every day." I said, "Ma'am, them people are lying to you. Don't worry about me, sonny." I said, "But they're lying to you." "I'm okay, don't worry about it." What do you do with them? Verse 16, "As for the word that thou hast spoken unto us in the name of the Lord, we will not hearken unto thee." These people don't want to listen to the word. "But we will certainly do whatsoever thing goeth forth out of our own mouth to burn incense unto the Queen of Heaven." There's the first time that shows up in the Bible, the Queen of Heaven. Now, the Queen of Heaven has multiple names, depending on what culture you're dealing with. Why do they have a Queen of Heaven? This is a mother-son worship. This began back in Genesis chapter 10 and 11. Back then, it was called Nimrod, Semiramis, and they had a child named Tammuz. It's a mother-son worship. Okay, then this went in different cultures by a different name. Madonna is a normal name for this. In Egypt, the three was called Isis, Horeb, and Seb. IHS. You'll find that IHS in some of the Catholic churches where they'll stamp that in the offering plates or on the tables, IHS. They say, "Oh, that means in his service." Back in their robes. That's Isis, Horeb, and Seb. That's what that is. Mother-son worship coming out of Egypt. Several years ago, the Pope wanted to take this obelisk that was in Egypt. An obelisk is a Washington Monument. And he wanted that moved from Egypt to the Vatican City. He wanted it right there in the Basilica Square. He was trying to get any contractor to do this job for him. But the problem is, if you broke the thing, you was going to get the death sentence. So he didn't have too many takers on this. I mean, can you imagine a Washington Monument? You have to take the thing down and then transport it from Egypt all the way to Rome and then put the thing back up without breaking the thing. Well, one guy finally did it and got the job done. But that's a pagan symbol. Okay, that's coming from Egypt into Rome. In your Bible, another name for her is Diana. You'll find her in Acts chapter 19. Great is the goddess of Diana. Jupiter in pagan Rome. Fortuna in pagan Rome. In India, she was known as Isis or Israra. Another name for her is Juno. I think that's interesting. Juno. You know, I've got Juno.com, but that's a pagan mother. Our alma mater, that means virgin mother. And we'll find these things all over the place in America. You go around often, you'll go around certain political statues, certain political things. You may find Moses on one side, but you'll find some pagan on the other side. Nike, Adidas, those are pagan gods. Pan, things like these are all pagan gods. If you come down to Rensselaer, you'll see a couple gargoyles sitting right on the courthouse. looking over you when you walk in. Pagan things. Okay, the Queen of Heaven, you go up in Wisconsin, there's a church called the Church of Mary, the Queen of Heaven. They let you know. They know who they're talking about.
Right on I-4 in Orlando, it's huge.
In Orlando?
Yeah, you can't go to Disney World without going past it. It must take up 10 or 12 acres.
And it's called?
Church of the Queen of Heaven.
Really?
Yep.
Family video.
Family video?
With their monument.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, one right here in Lowell, they have a monument in all their parking lots.
Oh, okay. The obelisk?
Yeah,
the obelisk. The obelisk? Okay. Presbyterian. Oh, that's right. The Presbyterian Church in Rensselaer's got one. All over the place. Everywhere you go, these things. You got this paganism and Christianity kind of side by side. You see, and that's part of the Antichrist plan. Make it look all the same. Mm-hmm. Yep. Scott?
San Francisco Public Park, they put out a monument honoring all its non-aligned soldiers.
I think they ought to honor that prisoner that took out John Grogan, to be quite honest with you. They ought to give him a medal. They ought to give him a pardon. That's what I'd do if I was going Yeah. It's going downhill. Queen of Heaven. Okay, what does it say about the Queen of Heaven? Okay, burn incense unto the Queen of Heaven. And it says to pour out drink offerings unto her. As we have done, we, our fathers, our kings, our princes, in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, for then had we plenty of victuals and were well and saw no evil. See the purpose. Their motive for serving the Queen of Heaven is their pocketbook. That was their motive. Their stomach. Victuals, that's right. Their God is their belly. Look in Philippians chapter 3. And when you go in their church buildings, you'll see that they'll have a pulpit on one side over here and a pulpit on this side over here, and right in the middle, they've got the big table up there with the eats. Their focal point is putting something in their belly. Philippians chapter 3. Our focal point is the pulpit right there, the preaching of the word. Philippians chapter 3, whose God is their belly. They'll take this little cracker, patty cake, and hold that host in the air and say, my Lord and my God, hocus pocus dominocus. It was cracker, now it's Jesus. And then they put him in their mouth. They don't chew him because they don't want to break his bones. And then, if somebody upchucks, they have doctrines to cover that too. They got all that stuff kind of covered. Philippians chapter 3, verse 18. For many walk, of whom I have told you often, and now tell you even weeping, that they are the enemies of the cross of Christ, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is their shame, who mind earthly things. I was talking to one of these people one time, two different occasions, about an hour each time, and I could kind of razz him. He'd razz me, I'd razz him. And so the second time I had gotten to talk to him, the first time he didn't have his little Catholic manual beside him. So the second time I looked at him, I said, do you really honestly believe that you're eating Jesus? I mean, as in a cannibal, as in like that. And when I put it in that way, he kind of dropped his head, was a little embarrassed, but he reached down, got his little Catholic book up, flipped to a certain page, and he said, yep. And then I did the same thing like Dracula. I said, yeah, it's like a Dracula, you like to drink the blood? Flipped to his little manual. Yeah, Yeah. Yeah, that's what they believe. I can't imagine it, but that's what they believe. They actually believe they're crucifying Jesus Christ again. Verse 18, it says, "But since we left off to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven, to pour out drink offerings unto her, we have wanted all things and have been consumed by the sword and by the famine." And when we burned incense to the Queen of Heaven and poured out drink offerings unto her, did we make her cakes to worship her and pour out drink offerings unto her without our men? Without our men. Her men ain't there. Patty cake, patty cake. Making little cakes, little wafers. And you don't see it in America, but you go down to Mexico or in Spain or in Italy, they'll take the wafer, put it in a pole, long pole with a thing up top of the sun around it, like a monstrance. It's called a monstrance. Parade down the street. My Lord and my God. My Lord and my God. Bow down and pray to their God. They'll take the monstrance, put it on a little table, then you'll see the nuns down praying to it. It's paganism. It's paganism. That's 19. Queen of Heaven. The wafers, this is the cakes, the wafers are all associated with a pagan goddess. These cakes symbolize Baal, the sun god. In Egypt, these cakes were consecrated by a priest to become the flesh of Isis or Horus, Isis, and Seb. The host during the Mass is a continuation of the Egyptian paganism. And the priest of Baal was called a Kana Baal, which is where we get the word cannibal. Same things. What these cakes are is they're a perversion of the unleavened cakes in Leviticus chapter 2. Okay, verse 20, it says, "Then Jeremiah said unto all the people, to the men and to the women and to all the people which had given him that answer, saying, The incense that ye burned in the cities of Judah and in the streets of Jerusalem, ye and your fathers and your kings and your princes and the people of the land, did not the Lord remember them, and came it not into his mind? So that the Lord could not or could no longer bear, because of the evil of your doings and because of the abominations which ye have committed, therefore is your land a desolation and astonishment and a curse without inhabitant as at this day. Because ye have burned incense and because ye have sinned against the Lord and have not obeyed the voice of the Lord, nor walked in his law, nor in his statutes, nor in his testimonies, therefore this evil has happened unto you as at this day. Moreover, Jeremiah said unto all the people and to all the women, Hear the word of the Lord, all Judah that is in the land of Egypt. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, saying, Ye and your wives have both spoken with your mouths and fulfilled your hands, saying, We will surely perform our vows, a vows that we have vowed to burn incense to the Queen of Heaven, to pour out drink offerings unto her. Ye will surely accomplish your vows and surely perform your vows. Therefore hear ye the word of the Lord, all Judah that dwell in the land of Egypt. Behold, I have sworn by my great name." When God does that, that's you ain't going to change that. "Saith the Lord, that my name shall no more be named in the mouth of any man of Judah in all the land of Egypt, saying, The Lord God liveth. Behold, I will watch over them for evil, not for good. And all the men of Judah that are in the land of Egypt shall be consumed by the sword and by the famine, and until there be an end of them. Yet a small number that escape the sword shall return out of the land of Egypt into the land of Judah, and all the remnant of Judah that are gone into the land of Egypt to sojourn there shall know whose words shall stand mine or theirs. This shall be a sign unto you, saith the Lord, that I will punish you in this place, and that ye may know that my words shall surely stand against you for evil. Thus saith the Lord, Behold, I will give Pharaoh Hophra, king of Egypt, into the hand of his enemies, and into the hand of them that seek his life, as I gave Zedekiah, king of Judah, into the hand of Nebuchadrezzar, king of Babylon, his enemy, and that sought his life." Now, a lot of times when you get talking about the Queen of Heaven, and there's a couple good books you can get on this. Alexander Hislop's Two Babylons, good one. Ralph Woodrow has made it more simplified. Same idea. People get saying, well, you hate these folks. No, it's not the people we hate. It's the church. It's a false doctrine. And I've got in my office a book of 50 priests and nuns that got saved and came out of the church. It's pretty interesting reading. People often think, well, if you're raised in a wrong church, what hope do you have? You have a lot of hope.
Amen.
You got a lot of hope.
Yep.
When somebody sincerely follows their religious belief that they grew up in, they follow it sincerely, they will come across contradictions in that belief. All false beliefs have contradictions. Those contradictions will make them scratch their head and wonder about this. And when they're sincere, of a clear conscience, worshiping this way, the Lord will get the truth to them. Now, when the truth crosses their path, they have a choice. Accept, retain the false belief, or start searching for the truth. This is illustrated in the Bible by a man by the name of Cornelius, an Italian. Cornelius was an Italian who was devout in his beliefs. He was lost. He had a vision. They said, why don't you call for a guy named Peter and he's going to come talk to you. So here comes Peter. And when this Italian sees the first vicar of Christ, he bows down and worships him. Typical. And the vicar of Christ says, get up. Don't worship me. I'm a man like you are. Pope, don't do that anymore. Now, the part that they do obey Peter's example is when he cursed and swore that one night. That part they do obey. But Cornelius heard the gospel and got saved. Now, whatever religious background anybody comes from, if they are sincerely following that, God will get the truth to them. And you'll see that when they come under conviction. Usually, when I first moved to Rensselaer, I wrote Dr. Ruckman and I said, what do you do in a town full of Catholics? So he wrote back and he said, put out tracts all over the place. 10 reasons why I'm not a Catholic. Don't put the church name on it, not because you're scared, but because they won't read it if they turn over and see. First thing they'll do is they'll turn over and see what church it is. They see anything but Catholic, out the window it goes. So you don't put the church name on it because you want them to read it. Okay, and then what you'll find is when you witness to a Catholic, the first thing you'll find, they'll get mad at you. But that's a good sign. Because if they don't get mad, it shows they don't care. So if they get mad, that's a good sign because it shows they care. Shows their arguments are weak, but at least they care. Well, after they get mad, if they consider what you showed them some things, then they get scared. Because now they're doubting their system that they grew up in. And after they get scared, the next step is they get saved. And that's usually the pattern. And that pattern is not just for the Catholic Church, it's for any church that's promoting false doctrine. They'll get mad at you first. They'll get scared because you have revealed some inconsistencies in their beliefs. Then they get saved. Now it's interesting when you talk to a couple Mormon boys. You ever talk to a couple Mormon boys at length? They don't get mad at you. They don't get mad. Why? Because they're just doing their two-year duty, and when they're done with this two-year thing, they're done for life. And they don't care about what they believe. They'll just take notes and smile and be nice and all that stuff, walk out the door, and they won't believe a word you said. I've talked to many of them, never seen them get mad. Last time I talked to one, I said, well, don't forget, fellas, your God is a devil, your father's a devil, and you obey his lust. Have a good day, fellas. No anger, just a smirk on her face. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one for him. Okay, so that's Jeremiah 43 and 44. Any questions or comments? Brother Paul?